Please, speak as you might to a young child or a golden retriever.
It's an unfair game.
They're schemers. Schemers trying to control their little worlds.
Rich get richer, that's the law of the land.
It's just money.
Blasphemy! This is madness!
I drink your milkshake!
Everybody, welcome back to Milkshakes, Markets, Madness. My name is John Kutzmita. This is Brent Johnson. If you're new to the show, then you probably don't know what a dollar milkshake is. We break all of that down on the YouTube channel. If you head on over there using the handle Milkshakes Pod, you'll see at the top there's a playlist called Start Here. It'll take you down that rabbit hole. And hey, if you speak Spanish, we've got a Spanish channel now. You can head on over to Batidos Mercados Locura, which is Milkshakes Pod Espanol is the handle. Brent and I are doing a slightly different recording time, so we're all going to get to find out whether or not Brent is a morning person. But in the context of how people tend to feel or maybe function in the morning, it maybe kind of felt like all week the market had a little bit of market sickness or morning sickness.
Yeah, you know, it was... You know, obviously, with what's going on in the Middle East, that was kind of dominating the market all week. You know, good news, you'd see a surge. Bad news, you'd see a downturn. That and then the Fed minutes in the middle of the week, you know, I think really drove the week. And to be honest, I think probably for the next few weeks, you know, Fed speak and Middle East is probably going to dominate the markets. Although we do have some earnings coming out next week. We're getting into earnings season. But, you know, overall, you know, the markets had held up pretty well until, you know, Friday afternoon. They kind of sold off fairly hard. Not super hard, but they started to sell off, and we'll see where they go next week.
Yeah, you know, considering what was going on with the initial Hamas attack over the weekend, I mean, one would say that the markets kind of digested everything pretty well. I mean, yeah. There's certainly volatility. Bond markets enjoyed a bit of a bounce from that risk-off move, but if you had to take a guess on when risk assets and equities would finally feel the pinch, Friday probably wouldn't be most people's guess on the weekend.
Yeah, and that's there was a bunch of stuff this week, right? We had the Fed minutes that came out on Wednesday, and then CPI, which is super important, came out on Thursday. CPI, you know, was hawkish. You know, it met expectations and was kind of a hot print. And bond market sold off pretty hard on Friday. Interestingly, then it bounced on. I'm sorry, sold off pretty hard on Thursday. And interestingly, then bounced pretty hard on Friday. And it'll be interesting to see if that's totally geopolitically, you know, related, a flight to safety, or if it's just a bounce and people are still trying to digest, you know, Fed minutes and Fed speak and all that kind of stuff. You know, I kind of tend to think that's probably a bounce and we're probably going to go lower in the short term in bonds. But, you know, with the when you get geopolitical stuff, you just don't know. And bonds have come down so much. You know, it wouldn't surprise to have kind of a dead cat bounce. We've kind of seen that a little bit over the last week or so. But I think the market, you know, especially with the Fed minutes coming out and we've got a bunch of Fed speakers next week, it's going to be interesting to see whether what the Fed says can kind of overpower the fiscal needs of the United States. Because now, especially with another potential, you know, geopolitical / military demand on U.S. budgetary needs, it's not going lower, right? The budget's going higher. And the demands that that will put on the markets, on the dollar, on yields, I think probably means yields on the medium to long end stay higher and perhaps even go higher, regardless of what happens on the front end and what the Fed does.
Do you think that's what we don't get too much into bonds? It's certainly more my preference how much it, you know, it drives the real estate mortgage market. I mean, the bond market's the largest market as well. The narrative behind it's been pretty consistent since 2022. You've had The Fed getting this transitory thing completely wrong, 40-year high inflation, inflation in some forms or another being sticky or anchored, monetary policy reacting to that, not just here in the U.S., but globally. Every time it feels like the bond market's starting to kind of get its feet under it, something else comes along, at least get its feet under it from a standpoint of what policies are doing to combat inflation. Then something comes along and kind of throws it off. I mean, there's definitely a bit of a bid this week because of all of the risks that was going on. But do you think right now, assuming there isn't, you know, more repercussions and there's this doesn't escalate worse in the Middle East, do you think bonds are pretty much driven right now, maybe less so about the inflation print? Because although it was hawkish, it's not like inflation's getting worse. We're trending in the right direction. Do you think this is purely supply-driven weakness right now?
I think probably for the most part. And also just the market coming to terms with, regardless of what the Fed does, that the U.S. budget is going to be, you know, we're going to have a budget deficit. We're going to have a large budget deficit. And, you know, even if the Fed doesn't hike from here, I think this is partly, it's a couple things. One, it's the demands of the U.S. budget. And then also it's sort of like the market coming to terms with, well, maybe it'll be okay as well. So, and what I mean by that is I don't think that the long end is selling off because people are afraid the U.S. is going to default on their bonds. I think the long end is going up because there's an increasing perception that maybe we're not going to have this mega crash that a lot of people have predicted. And part of the reason I think we had such an inverted yield curve and that the long end didn't rise at least as quickly initially as the front end did was the expectation that it was going to throw us into this mega recession. And I think as that gets potentially pushed further out, people are like, well, you know, if we're going to stay higher for longer and we're not going to have this massive recession depression, well, then I want to get paid more for owning bonds, for owning U.S. treasuries. And so the long end is finally coming up. I shouldn't say nobody. Of course, there are a lot of people, and especially many of them on Twitter, that think that, you know, the Fed is not going to sell, or the U.S. is not going to pay these bonds, and that nobody's buying them, and as a result, the long end is going to spike because the U.S. can't fund itself. I don't think that's the case. I think they just want to get paid more in order to own them. I think that's part of it. The other thing is, you know, as the medium to long end rises, it makes the yield curve less inverted and it signals less of a recession, right? Now, it's still signaling recession. It is still inverted, but it's flattening out. And ultimately, you know, the Fed wants a flatter yield curve. They don't want a massively inverted yield curve. I think they still might get the recession that they're talking about or that they're trying to avoid. But, you know, people have been saying this for 18 months now that this recession is right around the corner and it just hasn't showed up yet. You know, I think and I think as people, you know, think about where they're going to allocate capital, bonds are becoming more attractive because the yield is so high. And if it goes a little bit higher and it no longer signals recession, maybe that's a way that, you know, the market can kind of kick the can down the road another, I don't know, 6 months, a year before we get into this, you know, loudly predicted recession. Again, I don't know for sure. I mean, nobody does. Anybody who comes on here and tells you this is what's happening and this is why and there's just no other option, you should probably run the other way pretty quickly. But that's kind of what I'm thinking about on the medium to long term of the curve.
Yeah, I mean, there's people who spend an incredible amount of time spelling out the various plumbings of the financial world, but particularly how bonds are behaving, Fed repos. I mean, these things take a while to chew through when people share them and post them. So when you're reading through those and you start to appreciate how complex even just an idea or concept like a repo is, and what the Fed repo facilities have been doing intentionally and unintentionally, it is sometimes a little silly for people to be jumping to these levels of certainty with their predictions on what the global economy or the world is doing in as far as U.S. bonds are concerned. And it's an interesting perspective that you share where, you know, maybe the long end is just finally catching up to the fact that there's more probability of a soft landing, and that if that's the case, you know, that, you know, the long end isn't going to outperform. There isn't going to be this bid for bonds because of a risk off moment. That's an interesting perspective and something worth watching. Now, with all that in mind, certainly with the recent CPI print, where the Fed policy rates are, and certainly where both short-term and long-term duration bonds are currently priced, how are you looking at the probably favorite safe haven of a lot of people, gold, in the face of continued real rates?
Gold is very interesting. You know, I think we talked about it a couple of weeks ago. I was saying that, you know, gold was finally pulling back. So post the last Fed meeting, when bonds sold off, the dollar jumped, and gold finally sold off. So gold had been holding up very well all year. As real rate, I tend to think that gold trades inverse to real yields. So the higher the real yield is, that's more of a headwind for gold. But the real yield had been rising all year, and gold had held up really well all year. And I think part of it was because so many people were thinking, well, the real yields aren't going to hold up. The Fed's going to be forced to cut. But then post last Fed meeting, they not only said there's more cuts ahead, but they took away the future rate cuts, right? So markets trade on future expectations. And so as the expectation for real yields to fall fell, then gold finally pulled back, and it pulled like $100 over a couple of weeks. And, I was saying, I think we talked about it, that I thought gold was setting up for a really nice buying opportunity. And it was, and listen, so gold bounced $100 in the last week, but my issue is that it bounced on geopolitical concerns and not necessarily, you know, the fact that real yields are falling all of a sudden. And, you know, I could even make an argument that perhaps real yields are going to go higher as a result of these geopolitical concerns. But so I actually think that gold probably is going to pull back now. I hate it when gold or any other oil or anything else spikes on geopolitical concerns, because it almost never lasts. And everybody always says, oh, it's different time. This conflict is different, right? This one, they're not going to be able to get under control. And listen, maybe they won't, but usually they do. And so I always hate it when you get a big bounce based on geopolitical concerns. And that's really what we've seen over the last week. And so I actually think that gold will pull back kind of into the over the next month. Now, I don't know. Maybe I didn't go out and sell all my gold yesterday because I'm all of a sudden a gold bear. But what I did do is I bought put options on the gold miners. And I did that for a couple of reasons. Was because I think gold will probably pull back. I don't know, but it probably will. Number two, I think the bounce in gold is due to what's going on in, you know, Israel and Gaza and, you know, the larger Middle East. And like I said, that typically doesn't happen. So I think there's a big war premium, for lack of a better way of saying it, in gold right now. The next part is that I don't know that you should put a war premium onto the miners the same way that you do to bullion. I understand why people think it does, and I understand why they bounced on that, but I'm not sure the war premium will last. And even if it does, I'm not sure a larger war in the Middle East necessarily means you want to own companies that are operating in the emerging markets, right? And so you could have a situation where gold stays relatively strong, but the miners pull back, especially if we get a sell-off in the broader equity market. If we get a sell-off in the broader equity market, and let's say gold holds up, and it wouldn't shock me to see the miners pull back, because they moved like 10%, 10 or 15% in a week. I mean, that's a big move, right? And so I just feel like for me, the risk reward of buying put options on the miners was worth it. Now, we'll see if I'm right or not. But that's kind of what I think about gold right now.
You know, one of the interesting things for me so far in this conversation is this idea that, well, first of all, I was mentioned many times, and you just highlighted markets trade on expectations. So for most of the year, and maybe longer than that, expectations have been so wrong that now they're, maybe they're, it's the wrong time to be giving up on those expectations, whether it be recession or what have you. But I like this idea that the market is finally accepting the fact that higher for longer is not necessarily going to kill the economy and is something that markets are going to have to live with. And so they're rebalancing around that, whether it be, you know, buying more of the long end or maybe even selling that depending on, you know, how they view the supply issues, but also in the context of the gold price, right? Like, okay, real rates might be a thing here for a bit longer. I don't need to be piling into gold at 1900, 2000. Taking a step back on gold, because I know you have the reputation as the dollar guy, but you're really a gold bug at heart. And we've talked about that in different episodes. We've done the WWJD where, you know, you're the free market vigilante where we give you the power of central banks and you talk about, you know, what role gold would play in that. But we don't necessarily spend a lot of time talking about, I guess, maybe the ideology around it. And there's two things you said to kind of start that point that I'd like you to extrapolate more. One is this idea that, you know, the inverse relationship with real rates and the gold price, generally why that is and kind of why you think gold plays the role that it does, certainly in some of these types of global risk scenarios and war premium type of environments like you just mentioned.
Well, I think in general, gold does well in those environments just because it has proven itself. It's a proven store of value and it's not somebody else's liability. So I think those are the two main things that are part of the reason why it's kind of seen as a safe haven. Gold is the most, I think it would probably be a competition between gold and the dollar, but gold would probably win, as gold is probably the most liquid thing in the world. In other words, there will always be a bid for it. You know, gold will never go no bid, especially in some kind of a conflict. Whereas, you know, depending on what's happening geopolitically, a country's bonds or a country's currencies or some kind of a security that is somehow backed by a company or a country, could potentially, nobody would want it at any price because of what's happening to that particular company or country. But nothing can really happen to gold to make it go no bid. You know, it can't be inflated away. It can't be destroyed in a deflationary collapse. And literally for centuries and millennia, it has been a, you know, perceived store of value and flight to safety. And I think, you know, that to me, that's one of the big things different between gold and Bitcoin. You know, a lot of times they get compared, but Bitcoin has never really proven itself in that scenario. Not saying it can't, perhaps it can, but, you know, there's a couple thousand years of history showing that gold proves itself in that scenario. So that's part of it. As far as real yields go, and this is, it probably doesn't matter as much for an individual as it does for big companies or corporates or pension funds or, you know, bigger, larger players. But because those bigger players kind of set the prices, it ends up affecting individuals. But you're really, you know, part of the reason, you know, one of the big knocks on gold is it doesn't pay anything, right? It doesn't pay you a cash flow. You basically buy something and it just sits there and it doesn't do anything, which is kind of true. I don't necessarily think that's a bad thing. I don't think everything you own has to be paying you a stream of cash flows. And I think, you know, I think of gold as an insurance policy that pays off when I need it to. But that doesn't change the fact that the people who say that, they're correct. Gold doesn't really do anything until it has to. And maybe it doesn't need to do anything for 5 or 10 years. And so you kind of have an asset sitting there for, I don't know, 5, 10, 15 years that doesn't provide you any value other than the insurance that it potentially could pay you. Right. And so when you compare a zero yielding entity like gold to something else that is paying you a cash flow or a yield, then that typically would make the cash flow or the yielding security more attractive. This becomes less important when real yields are low, because if real yields are low, in other words, whatever yield you're getting is not outpacing inflation, and real that would make real yield zero. In that kind of an environment, since gold can't be inflated away, gold performs very well. Or if you get into a negative real yield situation, where even though you're getting paid a cash flow, you're losing in real terms, that makes gold even more attractive because, gold is seen as an inflation hedge. It can't be diluted by printing more of it, so to speak. But the flip side is if real yields rise, and you know, when we were in a zero rate environment for a number of years, that made gold more attractive. But as interest rates have started to rise, and as they rise more, you're kind of getting penalized more and more for not owning a yielding asset as opposed to owning, you know, a zero yielding asset like gold. And so, and I think that's largely what gold trades on. You know, if you took out the possibility for geopolitical conflict and just traded on real yields, there was no potential flight to safety trade, then I would say real yields is even more important to the price of gold. But I think what happened over the last week is where it starts to get complicated, because real yields did not crash hugely over the last week, but yet gold was up $100. So that shows me that over the last week, gold was not trading on real yields. Or I guess you could say that with what went on geopolitically, it increased the likelihood that the Fed would stop raising and that they would cut and that yields would fall as a result. And so then potentially real yields did go down, right? And so maybe there is some of that into gold as well. But when you get those two things either competing against each other or working together, that's when you kind of get these big moves in gold. And I think that's what we've seen over the last week. Now, here's the flip side. We've got a lot of Fed speakers next week, right? Let's say for whatever reason, the events in the Middle East don't escalate from here. And in fact, they either stay here or even tone it down a little bit. You know, I read this morning that, you know, Israel postponed their massive, entry into Gaza to give the citizens more time to leave. Maybe that lasts a few days. I don't know. But that was part of my thesis for buying the puts, is that they probably wouldn't go in over the weekend. And so far, it looks like they're not going to. And so if that gets delayed and you have the Fed speakers come out next week and continue to say that, you know, we're not planning to cut anytime soon, then you could see the expectation for real yields to rise again. And that could cause gold to pull back. And that was kind of, and that's those two things, you know, the potential halt to the entry into Gaza and the expectations for real yields to stay higher is part of the reason that I bought those puts on the miners.
Yeah, that's kind of where I was going to lead you a little bit there, because I'm curious. And I know sometimes it's maybe dangerous or even foolish to play with hypotheticals because you can go down all these windy roads. But if the U.S. actually got their fiscal house in order, and you know this massive amount of supply wasn't as big of a eyesore in terms of where just the U.S. credit rating is and where you know the spending is going and the overall economy is. And looking back maybe even a little bit in terms of recent price history, it wasn't that long ago, 2018, 19, where, you know, gold was what, $1,500? So in that environment, because if real rates and real yields are performing without that, you know, deficit explosion concern and that pressure on markets on how they allocate capital, do you see this creating a lot of downside pressure on gold, and where would you see kind of government spending and all these types of factors, how did they play into kind of that price suppression in 2018?
Well, I think because of the budget, I think the government is going to spend a lot of money, and when the government spends money, that tends to keep prices somewhat elevated. So barring one of these massive crashes that many are predicting, in which case you would get massive deflation and not inflation. Barring that, I think there's pressure for prices to stay higher from the massive U.S. budget deficit. So I don't. So that is part of the reason why I think rates could stay higher. You know, it barring a crash, and I think that would be at least a headwind for gold. It doesn't necessarily mean that it would kill gold, but it'd be a headwind. I don't think we're going to get into a good fiscal situation in the U.S. I never say never, but that's a pretty tough one for me to jump on board with. And so I don't see a massive fall in gold and then where it stays down for 10 years. Now, in some kind of a liquidity event, gold could easily fall $200 or $300, just like it did in 2008, just like it did in 2020. I've said this many times. When you get into that type of environment, you don't sell what you want. You sell what you have to, or you sell what the margin clerk wants, and whatever's liquid is what gets sold. And every time this has happened before, gold gets sold, but then gold recovers quicker than everybody else with the policy response to that. So I kind of feel like if gold does have a big pullback here, you know, sometime over the next couple of months or whatever it is, I think that's probably a fantastic buying opportunity. This is part, I really wanted to buy more gold. And I even, like I said, we talked about this a couple of weeks ago. I thought gold was setting up for a great buying opportunity. But I don't believe buying on a geopolitical event is, in my mind, that is not a great buying opportunity. Now, it could end up being one, but I just, that to me, that's not a reason to buy. Especially when I already own plenty, right? If you didn't own any, then you probably should have been buying. And there was clients that I have that hadn't, a couple of new clients that we bought gold for. So, you know, it's one of these things where if you don't own any gold, you probably should go buy some. But if you already own it, I don't feel the need to go buy more of it right here.
I get it.
Let me say one other thing though, before I forget. I think there's so many people, and this is probably a function of just, you know, me living where I live and, you know, well, I guess I'm in Puerto Rico now. I'm sort of in the U.S., but not totally, right? But there's just so many people I talk to that are just so focused on the problems of the United States, and they're so focused on the dollar. And again, I think once you realize that gold is going to go a lot higher, more because of what's going on outside the United States than because of what's going on inside the United States, the more you're going to be able to understand this, or at least the more you'll be able to think about it rationally. And that doesn't mean that there's not problems in the U.S., and it doesn't mean that there's not things going on in the U.S. that should lead you to buy gold. But, you know, this is kind of my thesis, is that things are going to get really, really bad all over the place, not just the U.S. And in many ways, the U.S. will be able to handle these bad events better than many of these other places. And I think these other places, there's going to be increasing demand for gold. If you look at a chart of gold in all the different currencies, it's in a bull market in every currency except for the dollar, right? And maybe you could even consider it in a bull market for the dollar if you want to. I don't really have a problem with that. But the point is, gold has gone up a lot more in other currencies than it has in the dollar. And I think that is going to continue. And that's where I think a lot of the demand will come from.
I was going to tease you. I could get the little bit of a sense, a little bit of bias, a little bit of resentment that the market took away your buying opportunities.
It did. It did. I'm actually, but you know what? If I'm right, I'm going to get an even better opportunity. If I'm not right, I'm just going to have to sit with the position we already have, and I'll have to buy on a pullback to a higher low at some point. But you're right. I was like really I was ready to go in big, and then this happened. I'm like, ugh, here we go again. And this has happened so many times over. I should actually go find them. There's been, I don't know, three or four times over the last 10 years where, you know, gold gets this bid based on this, you know, flare up in the Middle East, or a, you know, military operation in Africa or wherever it is. And every time on Twitter, I'm like, be careful, this never works out. And it never does. But you know, at some point it will. At some point, this really will be it, and gold will be off to the races, and, you know, we'll see what happens.
Well, I'm proud of you. I saw you this week post a link to one of our videos as a point of reference. You're starting to now use the podcast as your own catalog. And I could see, you know, this conversation here, when people start to try to jump on you about the dollar, you can say, look, you know, you don't understand my pragmatism here. I like gold. I like these harder assets, but
I love gold.
Yeah. I love gold. So that's good to kind of get your thoughts on that, you know, where you're seeing it in the short term. And obviously you've shared before why you think it's important in the long term. I don't want to extend this too much longer, but I do want to bring it back to some fundamentals because, you know, having these conversations, it's good to speak on the high level, but I do appreciate sometimes when we bring it down to the more simpler level. You did reference counterparty risk. And I think this is just such a huge one, especially when I think about 2020. A lot of people don't understand that some of the things that went on in the shadow markets and how out of control that really, really got because of all these knock-on effects and counterparty risks. Can you talk real briefly about what a counterparty risk is and why you feel like it's not really in existence when it comes to holding gold?
Well, so first of all, there is counterparty risk with gold, and people are going to say, no, there's not. And I'll tell you why there is. But anyway, counterparty risk is basically, typically when you make an investment, there's somebody on the other side of the trade, right? Or, you know, if you buy a bond, that company is responsible for paying you the cash flows and then giving you your money back. So that company is your counterparty. If you buy a stock option or if you buy a put option on Nike, the exchange, the options exchange, is your counterparty. Let's say you buy a put option on Nike expecting Nike to crash, and it does. And you're like, holy cow, that was a great trade. But the options exchange goes bankrupt, you don't get paid. So that's a situation where you got it right, you made a great trade, but you still didn't make any money because your counterparty went bankrupt. Now, years ago, this wasn't a big deal, but, you know, kind of 2008 and later, it became a very big deal, especially when it happened with, you know, when the global financial crisis, there were people who bought options or derivatives or had these complex, you know, derivatives trades on to short the housing market, right? But the problem got to be so big that even the people that were right worried they were not going to get paid because the banks were literally going bankrupt, right? And so the that is a case where counterparty risk really comes into play. Because typically when you have a brokerage account somewhere or an investment, it's a lot of times it's with a financial institution, some type of a financial, a brokerage firm, a bank, a bank-like company, some kind of an exchange, a crypto exchange, whatever it is. You know, crypto is another good example where, you know, you've had, you know, these exchanges have gone bankrupt. So even though you might have been making great trades, the people who were actually custodying or were on the other side of the trade went bankrupt. And so that is, so that's a counterparty. Now, the reason there is counterparty risk with gold, gold itself can't get destroyed. Gold itself can't get inflated away. But my guess is you don't have, you know, a standing army, an aircraft carrier and some F-16s that are guarding your house in order to protect your gold, right? And so oftentimes, people that own gold will store it somewhere else, in a vault, in locked up in a mountain somewhere, perhaps in a bank or some kind of a storage facility that, you know, nobody knows about. But then you are you're kind of the counterparty to that entity that's doing the store of value for you, or the store of the gold for you. So that's kind of counterparty risk. And if you don't think that this is real, just look at Venezuela is a very good example. Venezuela owned a lot of gold, but they had it stored in England, in the UK. And when the Western world put sanctions on Venezuela, they said, you know what, we're not going to give you your gold back. That's a perfect example of counterparty risk. Gold did just fine. Gold did exactly, in Venezuelan Bolivar terms, gold did exactly what it was supposed to do. But because your counterparty didn't give you your gold back, it didn't matter. So that's counterparty risk, and it's a really it's an important thing, and it's becoming increasingly important.
Yeah, I mean, we won't get into it now in this episode, but the FTX, SBF, Sam Bankman-Fried trial's been going on. So, I mean, right in the spotlight, we have a perfect example of those counterparty risks and how many people on the institutional side trusted that exchange, trusted that enterprise. and then had some very bad news to share with their clients. I would also add too, you referenced the housing market. You know, the people had different types of short positions and option plays to benefit from that downturn. In the movie The Big Short, which has really crystallized that whole event for a lot of people, I think some people miss very kind of short wrap-up or segment at the end when Michael Berry, Christian Bale, is on the phone, I think with Goldman Sachs at that time. But he couldn't get fair price for his contracts despite what was going on in the MBS markets and everything else that was going on in the housing market, because his counterparties were not playing fair, and they were waiting until they had a similar position before allowing anyone to actually monetize it at market prices. So I don't know if people who are familiar with that movie, if you're familiar with that scene, you could probably find it on YouTube, but that's a great example of just because you're the smartest person in the room doesn't mean you're going to get paid. And there's a lot of people who've experienced that in different times over the last 20 years, and some of them become very jaded, angry individuals after experiencing that. So yeah, make sure you know your counterparties. But in this episode, we are not your counterparties. We're just sharing interesting information about what's going on in the market. And you have no liabilities listening to our conversation. But hopefully everybody enjoyed it. You know, we don't know what's going to happen this weekend, but we do know what's on the economic calendar for next week. And if you have some time, please join us on Monday for our Peak of the Week segment, where we'll go over some of those data points, get you ready for the week ahead. And of course, the unpredictable nature of what's going on in the Middle East will be a wild card that all of us will keep close tabs on. Brett, before we wrap up here on this full-length episode, any last comments or thoughts you want to share with the Milkshakes crowd?
No, I think, yeah, we've been saying all year that Q4 had the potential to be pretty interesting, and God, so far it's becoming that way. This is one of those things with the Middle East where I would prefer that it didn't get more interesting. I would prefer that it went back to be very boring, but I don't know if we'll be so lucky. Anyway, I hope everybody has a great weekend.
Yeah, I second that notion, Brent. I certainly second that. It's been a foggy week on both head and heart, and we certainly send our condolences out to anyone who's impacted by it. I guess we should just kind of leave it there. It's a very complex situation.
Amen.
Amen. All right, we'll see you guys soon. This show is provided for entertainment and informational purposes only. It should not be relied upon as legal, business, investment, or tax advice. Neither the hosts, guests, nor any funds they may manage intends to make an offer or solicitation for the sale or purchase of any specific securities, investments, or investment strategies.